This episode is supported by The Finch, a seasonal American restaurant in Clinton Hill, and by C Management, a global leader in creative talent management.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague, author, published author Souther Teague.
Congratulations on your book coming out yesterday.
Thank you.
That was a really...
thank you, Dave.
That was audience. A really wild release party for your book that you had last night.
Yeah, it was. It was...
I don't remember any of it.
Yeah. It was memorable and unmemorable at the same time.
Yeah. I didn't even have one.
Didn't have one, no.
What the...
it's weird. I guess this is how it works. We did the pre-release for the press 2 weeks ago yesterday at Porchlight. And then we did a second pre-release in L.A., where I was last week, for BevCon. Mm-hmm. And then there isn't really a thing you do on release day. So
You're wrong.
In a couple...
You know what? How many I've had like at my bar?
I don't know. Jeff Ashworth, my editor, publisher, and friend. Jeff, what the hell? You didn't plan anything for yesterday? I just had a quiet dinner. Me and Kimmy Winkler went to dinner at Mercer Kitchen. Then we went to Sweetwater Social and had a glass of champagne. Sorry, Todd, I drank a glass of champagne. I wasn't supposed to be drinking this month. I'm going to drink today, though.
A lot of great stuff. Yeah, the month's over. It's pretty much over.
Anyway, the book is out. I appreciate all the well wishes and texts and emails and Instagram posts that I've gotten from everybody. It's pretty incredible. Go check out my Instagram at Creative Drunk, and you can see my stories. I've been reposting everybody's pictures of the books and things like that. It's overwhelming. I'm really overwhelmed. Like... My publisher texted me today to say that I'm number 3,811.
3,180
there
is what I read.
Okay. So I'm inside, I'm close to inside of 3,000 of all books on Amazon.
That's crazy.
I don't know how many books they have, maybe 4,000?
they got more than that.
It's pretty incredible. It's overwhelming, and I feel really proud of the product, and I hope the listener goes out and buys a copy And then if you ever see me and you have your book with you, I'll absolutely put my signature in there.
Or I'll sign
Damon's name.
That's the only way I can get in that book.
You'll be in the next one.
All right. Fine.
Next one's going to be about cocktails and cowboy hats and motorcycles.
Call it, you're in the wrong place?
Yes. You're in the wrong room. Hey.
Yeah, nice. So you're at BevCon. What happened there? You did a bunch of stuff there. You were only there for like...
I did. I was there for a
couple
real...
days?
Yeah. I think I didn't calculate it, but it was like 50 hours. You know me. I fly right after I leave work, and I fly in to go right back to work. I got out there. I did a talk about pop-up bars, and then I did a pop-up. I took over Harvard and Stone with our good friend Aaron Polsky. He used to work at Amore Margo, and now he's the head bartender at Harvard and Stone. So we did an event there. It was really successful. Like, wow, I was really super busy. Tiny bar in the back. They have like what they call R&D, a secondary bar in the back of this giant bar. Small room, not very much larger than a Amore Margo, so I felt right at home in that regard, but it was just jam-packed to the rafters with people.
Cool.
And then I did, I was the guest on a couple of podcasts while I was out there, including Jack Inslee. I wasn't even paying attention to the fact that the Line Hotel is the same Line Hotel that's in D.C.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee.
There's Jack.
Hey,
what's up, Jack?
Hey.
So Jack pulled me in and did a quick interview with me. So, you know, I'll post all that stuff on our media as well. And then I did a book signing, which was crazy. We sold out. Didn't have many.
Sell out.
Yeah, I've definitely sold out. We didn't have that many, but still, it felt really good to be like, all right, people came to get them all. I don't know, and then I flew back and I went to work at Amore Margo like normal. I'm trying to live a normal life and also live this very unusual life right now.
You're a very unusual person.
Thanks.
Makes a lot of sense.
It's true. You were away as well. We didn't do a show last week, but you were away. You were at Camp Runamuck, second session this year.
Yeah, yeah. So second time there, second time sponsoring a cabin. Brooklyn Gen has a cabin there. And the thing about this session, it was you know, lots of lovely people. Great to meet all these campers. But the thing is, as a sponsor, you don't get to hang out and go on the tours
right
with the campers during the day.
Blessing and a curse, I'm sure.
Well, you know,
they have to get up early, as I recall.
They do. That's true. That's true. And they stay up real late.
Yep.
But it was cool this session because we got to hang out with a lot of really great people who were like other sponsors, mm-hmm. you know, and had a lot of fun. Went to the go-kart track twice. But, you know, we got to like kind of make our own tours, which was actually ended up being a much more personal, like one-on-one vibe. Went to Michter's. Dan McKee, who's been on the show before.
Yep. Great guy.
About a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Showed us around. And we went to their new visitor center, which is going to be open in November, they're saying.
Right. They were talking about it on the show a year ago, that they're building it. Yeah. So it's almost done.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Getting close. It's beautiful. And then went to Wild Turkey. And Bruce Russell got to show us around.
Who popped in on us the other day.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so that was really fun, man. We got to hang out in the Rickhouse A, and like I did an interview with them.
Oh, cool.
And Benny Hurwitz, who's their like brand ambassador, Joanne, who's also in the family. It was great, man. Did a little interview, tasted a bunch of whiskey out of the barrel. Had like a really nice personal, like real, real deep experience with that. So that episode will be out soon. And then we also went to Rabbit Hole Distilling, which is, mm-hmm. it's been open for about a year now.
Right.
And they, it's Christopher Wilkins, who used to be the brand ambassador for Copper and Kings, and he helped start up this new whiskey distillery. Beautiful spot. It's like super like modern. It almost looks like, it looks like the MoMA, you know, it looks like a museum in there. They've got a nice tasting room upstairs as well. So it's really interesting seeing three very, very different distilleries. Michter's being more of like factory style. They don't do tours at Michter's.
Right.
That's why they're building the visitor center. To Wild Turkey to see how like the influence of Campari has changed their visitor center. But then you're still like seeing the big fermenter tanks, the
really old rickhouses. Yeah.
There's 28 rickhouses.
Yeah.
It's insane. And getting to hang out in those dusty like cobweb,
mm-hmm.
like there's snakes and spiders
I love that stuff.
You know?
I love that stuff.
And then go into this very modern, like beautiful, architecturally just like stunning modern distillery, and to see those three different styles is really cool.
Makes me curious to know what the modern one will look like when it's as old as Wild Turkey is now.
Right?
It'll still look sleek.
It's still going to look like a spaceship.
Yeah, probably will.
Anyway.
That sounds like it was a great time.
That's the recap for my end from last week. But yeah, it's, you know, the community down there is really strong. You know, every time I go down to Kentucky, it's like, You taste all these different whiskeys, and like they're in competition with each other, but everyone knows each other, and it's like,
I think they're all perfectly aware of the notion that the popularity of bourbon and rye whiskeys that are made in America is good for all of them.
Bruce was saying, and Jimmy Russell, they were saying that they used to get about 15 tourists a week. And now they have groups of 25 every 30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, and within his lifetime, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right? That's incredible.
Yeah, and it just shows, like, you know, like they're in Bardstown, there's this company, it's Bardstown Bourbon Distillers or something like that. They only do contract distilling. They're actually building, like, a resort-style, like, hotel kind of thing there because of, like, the amount of, like, whiskey tourism there is.
Is the pool going to be filled with new make?
Yeah. I hope not.
Anyway. Well, let's get into our show today.
Yeah, I think we've got some whiskey to drink here, too.
We do. Well, we've also discussed
amongst other things.
Exactly. And we've also got a lot of like things to talk about. Today in the studio, we've got a co-owner of Night Owl Hospitality, which is a Jersey-based cocktail catering company, Diana Pettit. Is that saying your last name right?
It's Pettit. It rhymes with charcoal briquette.
I'm like, see, I have that too. I do. It's Souther, like other with an S.
Yeah.
But then Alfred chimes in and he goes, others? And also, Scott Rosenbaum, you guys are also adjunct professors now at NYU, it's a local college here in New York City, teaching a multi-session graduate seminar about the history, culture, and policies of drinking from the Neolithic period to the present day, 9,000 years of intentional drinking and making alcohol, right? And it's, I think it's important to note that that's the key word, right? Intentional, not just accidentally making alcohol and drinking. So, Diana Pettet, like briquette.
Also, welcome Scott back Rosenbaum. To the show.
Yeah, Diana was before. On the show. Yeah, exactly.
I know, I've never been on the show.
Haven't you?
No, I think that I'm just sort of hang out enough around here. It seems like I've been on. I've been on the Cutting the Curd because my background's really cheese.
Oh, yeah, so. That's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been on for cheese.
Because I know we had talked about you being on the show, but then I know that, like, yeah, because you were on with Ian Saxelby, and yeah, I don't know. I'm just getting old. I forget things. But anyway, well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I thought it was your second time.
No, it's my first. I'm very excited because I love listening to your show.
So we sure have guest. Talked a lot about booze.
Yes.
Cool. All right. And yeah, all right. Let's get to it. Like, all right. What started this? How did you get into the idea of putting this class together? I mean, obviously, like, there's a lot of research involved, like historical accounts, things that you kind of have to debunk and kind of figure out what is closest to the truth, you know.
Right. Well, the class came about, both Scott and I have master's degrees from NYU's food studies program. And food studies is not a nutrition course or a food science course. It's looking at the symbolic meaning of food. So what food means to us, what it conveys about what we value. It also conveys human history and all that.
It's food meets liberal arts. So if you don't want to get a job at a restaurant, but you want to talk about and learn about food.
Yeah.
That's food studies.
Gotcha.
Or the symbolic meaning of food. Anyway, we touch upon alcohol in our studies, in our master's studies, but don't really focus on it. And I don't know, after several years after graduating, it sort of hit me like there should be a course just on the history of alcohol. Because what distinguishes alcohol from food is that we don't really need it, right? The only beverage we need is water.
Speak for yourself, lady.
Okay, yes. Well, there's a heavy desire for it, but
no, I totally agree. In fact, I've said this before in front of large audiences to boos and hisses. Like, I feel like, you know, we have to be aware that what we do is 100% frivolous. It's unnecessary. And in fact, you could probably live a longer and healthier life if you didn't have it. Now, you have to factor in, like, your mental health, maybe then that's where you need that alcohol to make your life better.
Right.
Right.
And then you touch upon really sort of what's at the core of our class in some ways is that, you know, we don't need alcohol, and yet we've had this 9,000-year love affair with it. It's a bit of a rocky love affair, you know, ups and downs, and sometimes we want to break up, as we tried during various prohibitions, but we always end up getting back together again. So we look at a lot of the different sort of forces, historical forces, cultural forces, personal forces that sort of keep humans engaged in alcohol.
And it happens at all levels, too. You know, we often think of our relationship with alcohol on personal terms, but, you know, we see governments try to break up and make up with alcohol with regard to prohibition or taxation, and we explore it on kind of different levels. Of
sure. Well, I mean, even since prohibition, you know, in America, the federal government gave the states the right to figure out what they wanted to do as far as the laws go, and making such a fractured system that we have in general, right? Is that fair to look at?
Yes, we can. We can thank the 21st Amendment for that. You know, but we see it play out not just in the U.S. We look at, you know, a lot of people think that. For various, sometimes wrongheaded reasons, that our Puritan, you know, background means that we've been kind of prohibitionist from the start. But we see Russia have issues with regard to prohibition and trying to ban it.
They had prohibition in Russia from Tsarist times up to Stalin, actually, multi-year prohibition. And, you know, alcohol is often that relationship, I can't quit you, and actually the government couldn't quit alcohol because up to a third of the state's revenue came from alcohol sales. So once
right.
you know, as you mentioned, that maybe we'd all do a little bit better without alcohol, but when the government tries to limit it, when we know humans are going to go find it anyway, and then you dry up the coffers, and that leads to other problems.
Yeah, government comes to a grinding halt. Services, infrastructure, everything suffers because so much money comes.
I mean, the first taxes were on alcohol in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something to think about.
Yeah.
Next time you're pouring a barrel of beer down the gutter.
Yeah, exactly. those pictures from Prohibition where they're whacking up barrels just mind-boggling to me. Like, they're just dumping money down the tubes. And it, like, obviously trying to be, trying to make a better situation for everyone, you know, trying to do a social good. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, best intentions. But, man, terrible, terrible, catastrophic results. Like, how many people died during Prohibition because they got poisoned by our own government, right? Mm-hmm.
Which you bring up in your book.
Yeah, I do. Have you read it already?
I've made a good dive into it.
Academics, man, they crush through books.
It's like, I gotta start reading it.
Yeah. I do mention it in there, and it's staggering to even understand that the government would take such a stance that they. So basically what happens, they poisoned alcohol and kind of didn't really tell anyone, but sort of let the information leak out. Like, if you drink alcohol, you may in fact die. And it didn't stop anybody from drinking it. So lots of people did die. Right? It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that, you know, I don't think I've said it out loud maybe, and I definitely haven't written it down anywhere, but like, I've always kind of thought, and maybe you can weigh in, if we as a society or as a people had never discovered alcohol yet, and we discovered it today, I think it would be illegal. I don't think we would ever mix it into the thing at all. It would definitely be like a class 3 like substance, right?
I definitely think so. I mean, oftentimes, sort of like, you know, in drug debates, people remind us that alcohol is a very deadly drug, and it's a problem that, you know, wrecks lives and societies and whatnot, and yet there it is. You know, it's been with us for at least 9,000 years, and I don't think we're going to quit it anytime soon.
But the lines are always shifting too. You know, we explore how different periods in different periods of time, different cultures accept or reject alcohol. So, you know, we understand today that part of Islam is a prohibition on alcohol, but in the early years that was not codified, and there are pictures of Muslim people getting wrecked. Drawings, of course, not photographs, but, you know, why and how did that change is something that's always subject to great debate and academics arguing. But it's fascinating because everything's always in flux. It's always changing,
right,
with regard to attitudes.
And yeah, it sort of can, I mean, always a tension with alcohol, as we mentioned, you don't really need it. And there's really good aspects of alcohol, right? It's a source of hydration. It's a source of great nutrients. Also, it's a great social binder as well. And that's usually in moderation. And then you go to the flip side and have too much of it, and then it becomes the opposite, right? It's going to ruin your health. It's going to ruin social structures. So always there's some sort of institution, whether it's religious, political, cultural, that's trying to figure out how to get people towards the moderate good use of alcohol and not go towards the other end of alcohol.
I think it's kind of worth noting and a little bit shocking to me that people are very acutely aware of dosage of drugs. They're acutely aware of how many milligrams of ibuprofen are in their pills. They're acutely aware of how much CBD is in the new CBD oil vape thing, so they can, or the edibles, so they can know what they're dosing themselves. And right on the bottles of spirits, it tells you what the dose is, percentage of alcohol by volume. But people tend to not think about that at all.
Well, that would require reading a label, you know.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. They read all these other labels, and they're very, like, they know what they're doing and what they're taking. But
what do you mean by that? I mean, like, do you?
I think of the example that's coming to my mind
when I have a headache and I take 2 Advil, right?
Yeah,
it's like, it's not going to hurt if I take 4. You know, and sometimes I might need 4 Advil. You know, in a single dosage.
Yeah.
So I mean, like,
but I think.
But are you saying socially? I think or, what like,
I'm saying.
Responsibly,
I think what I'm saying is kind of the sort of weirdly backwards of what you're saying. I notice, as a bartender, maybe you do too when I say it like this, I notice as a bartender that I don't think people, okay, at my bar where all the drinks cost the same price, I don't think people realize that there are different ABVs. When they come in and they say, oh my gosh, this is that bar where the only non-alcoholic ingredient is water. All the drinks are super strong. Well, actually, they're not. Like, a lot of my drinks are pretty low ABV.
Right, it's all vermouth and
the Adamaro Sazerac is made of 8 different Amari. Like, it probably taps out at 35%, so 70 proof cocktail. It looks like an old fashioned, right? But an old fashioned is typically at least 40%, so 80 proof. I've got I've always got an Americano style cocktail on draft, People drink a couple of those, and they think that's the same strength as drinking two, again, old fashions, let's say. Like, I don't think the average consumer is putting that math together.
I kind of disagree with you, especially, like, over the last, like, year or two, you know, with the trend of, like, low ABV cocktails.
Right.
I think people are, like, seeking that out. And, I mean, that also came, I think, what ushered that in is, like, session beers, you know? And I think people are more conscious about that. I mean, like, the Bamboo cocktail is great. It's a 50-50 of sherry and dry vermouth with orange bitters, you know? And, like, it drinks like, I'm not saying exactly like a Manhattan, but it feels like
exactly,
a,
of course.
It feels like a cocktail.
Walks like a duck, cocktail. Sounds like a duck.
Yeah, but the thing is, you can have...
Not a duck.
It's not a duck. It's not all it quacked up to be, you know?
Oh, man.
Where's
that trombone, Dave?
But actually, I'm going to go with you, Souther. I think that a lot of people don't... I think a lot of people don't know. And, you know, I think where you do see is with beers, right? It's very clear now when you go to a good beer bar, they say
I'm not saying the entire population.
Yeah. Sure.
But it is a thing that's coming to the spotlight.
I want to hear what she has to say, but I do notice that at beer bars, especially over other bars, especially the nerdy beer bars, mm-hmm. they literally list, like... Here's what this beer is. Here's where it's from. Here's what it tastes like. Here's its ABV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here's its ABV, right?
But yeah, but you know, you look at a cocktail list. You know, I'm coming from the Jersey Shore, where you know the vodka club rules heavily, and you know, look at a cocktail menu. Most people don't know what the ingredients are, and they can't do the math in their head about how much that cocktail is going to be in terms of ABV. So I think there's a lot to learn, but it is interesting. I think alcohol is sort of like this blind category drug, maybe, in the sense that it's just alcohol. And then some people don't even really know the difference between, you know, a distillate and a ferment and how how a fermented product. And there's a big gap in education about booze. And that's what's sort of interesting about the class and is that we all drink, or most of us all drink, but we don't really know what it is we're drinking, where it came from, why is it that we're drinking whiskey here and cognac in France and tequila down in Mexico, that there's all these reasons for it. And, you know, why did absinthe get banned and different things like that?
You know, in the world of kind of food and drink, it's fascinating. And one of the reasons we aim to kind of create this curriculum is that drink lags behind food by about 20 years in terms of academic interest. You know, here was this program that studied food, but there was never really a course on the cultural aspects of alcohol, even though it had been around for 20 years. And we see that, you know, with dining and cocktails as well. You know, farm to table, only in the last 10, 15 years have we started to see drinks kind of approach that.
Sure.
Well, not to mention especially here in the United States, specifically here in the United States, your contact and interaction with alcohol is 20 years later than your contact or interaction with food, right?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to drink until you're 21.
Yeah, right. And there's still taboos around it. I mean, food studies by itself just was sort of, I wouldn't say ridicule, but it took a long time to get into the academy because, you know, food is something you do to sustain yourself. It's a base art. It's not a high art to study. But now people, I think, understand that food is really worthy of study because everybody eats. It's a great lens to look at all human history and values and whatnot. And now alcohol studies is getting in there, but there's added to that this taboo about alcohol. You know, are you an alcoholic if you're studying about alcohol? You know, there's another sort of level of getting over to show it's why it's interesting to study.
Right. We brought up on the show not too many weeks ago how many words there are for someone who's interested in food, but how few there are for someone who's interested in alcohol. It's basically you're an alcoholic. Like you can be an epicure or a gourmand, mm-hmm. but if you just like to drink, you're an alcoholic.
Or if, as a woman, I could be a lush, too.
Yeah. There's no, like, positive words. They're all sort of negative.
For a long time, my grandmother thought my profession was alcoholic because I wasn't a bartender, but I worked in booze.
Yeah.
And that was the only language she had.
Professional alcoholic. I think that's what we all are. What, we got a laugh track now?
Yeah.
I conject that absinthe was considered such a taboo due to lobbyists, but that's a whole other show. We're at the halfway mark now. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and get academic and nerdy. And also, there's some real special bottles sitting here on the table, so we should sip on some stuff when we come back with Diana and Scott from NYU.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Missing you,
This episode is supported by The Finch, a seasonal American restaurant in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, where chef owner Gabe McMacken and his team are focused on creating a living restaurant where the choices they make consider the long-term health of the business and of the community. Learn more at thefinchnyc.com. This episode is also supported by C Management, a global leader in creative talent management, representing artists in the fields of photography, creative direction, styling, hair, makeup, manicure, and set design. C Management, management with a vision. Learn more at seemanagement.com. Work my pen, express my mind. I wrote this out
solitary, confined. My heart is stopped like hands of time. And we are back.
It's still liquid. Oh, sorry, we're back.
What?
I just poured some. I just poured some of this. What are we pouring? You tell me.
This is an Amaro from another place and another time. This is Algae Marine by Halger. This is an Amaro from Italy that dates back to the 70s. It's no longer produced in the kind of weird subculture of people seeking out what they call dusties. Kind of now from now extinct distilleries. This fits among a subset of really geeky people seeking out Amaro, which tends to age wonderfully, kind of mellow and marry the herbal flavor. So this has supposedly 73 different botanicals in it, and
among them is algae.
Yeah, one of them is algae.
Is there any particular reason why?
Well, I'm about to taste it. I'm curious if it's like salty. Is it going to be salty? Nope. It's got a lot of savory notes. It's definitely caramely. It's pretty warm. What's the ABV? Speaking of knowing your ABVs.
See, I did not read the label.
Now I know my ABVs.
It's on the back?
May not be on there, if it's old enough.
Yeah, it kind of rubbed off a little bit. I think it's around 30% ABV, yeah. If I had to guess.
Pretty warm for tomorrow. Ooh, it's making my mouth water a lot, though.
Yeah.
Get me right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. There's
thanks for bringing this. By the way, my pleasure. Really special.
You're right. There's a lot of people collecting dusty bottles. There's certain people who are essentially just brokers. They go and find a lot of like vintage cases and end up reselling them. Chamber Street Wines in New York City, they do a lot of vintage spirits, Amari and like vermouth. I bought some Punta Mez from them at one point.
They're wonderful. There are a number of restaurants. Fausto has a great vintage Amaro selection or Amari selection. Isodi, Del Posto are places where if you don't want to drop, $70, $80 on a full bottle, you just want to kind of taste around. Yeah. Also, Four Horsemen has a great
That's a great spot.
Selection.
Mm-hmm.
There's one Quince in SF is huge. Michael does a huge collection of dusty old bottles, but also a lot of just homemade stuff for his tasting program. But this is really cool.
It's quite tasty too. I'm curious to know why it didn't stand the test of time. Nobody wants to drink algae Amaro.
This is a perfect example of why there are these spirits that, because they were so ubiquitous, no one wrote anything down. And now you go and Google, you can type this into Google and you don't find any information.
Right.
There's no history, there's no story, because only now people are starting to take these things seriously or want to learn about them.
Yeah.
Right, so how much have we lost? How much just disappeared? How much didn't get written down? Didn't get
lost to time.
Didn't get written down. Oral history gone. The people who are making it or doing it are gone. It's just gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by bringing the Amaro back to our class, one of the things that we always come back to is alcohol is this healthful thing that it was medicine in many ways, both in consuming it, using it topically, and so of course Amaro comes from that tradition of lots of different herbs. And bitters you put into a bottle, put some sugar in there to make the bitters go, make the medicine go down. We don't really need Amari anymore in terms of medicine or curing stomach ailments, but they're still there. They're still part of the culture.
We still need it.
Yeah, okay, we take it back. We still need it.
There's There have been some really rough days that I've had where the only thing that fixed what ailed me was shot of Campari or
something. A little Underberg.
Yeah, Underberg. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit more about your class. It says it's a multi-session. So how many sessions are involved?
It's a semester-long class.
Oh, wow. Yeah, oh, wow. It's like full-on.
Yeah, it's a graduate seminar, a full credit, September to December.
15 full weeks of alcohol-fueled studying.
But no alcohol.
Nerdery. Alcohol-fueled nerdery.
All via books. Yeah.
It's theoretical drinking.
So, I mean, I guess obviously you like touch on a lot of the, like you were saying before, like the social aspects of it. We've talked about historical and political. Do you also touch on like the religious aspects of it? I mean, like, because there's a lot of.
Right. It's funny, as you said earlier, like the government has an on-off relationship. We have an on-off relationship. So does religion.
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned before, the forces that are trying to sort of balance out moderation versus overconsumption, you know, there's often religion comes in to play that role. And, you know, alcohol and religion have been there from the get-go, that a lot of the earliest evidence of alcohol in the human record is probably connected to religious rites. And, you know, it's always been there part of celebration as well.
And as you said before, too, medicine, you know, like the monks were definitely known for making medicinals. Mm-hmm. And being, you know, hospitable.
Beer, wine.
Hospitable to their guests when they came by.
Benedictine.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But then also, I mean, like, I grew up Lutheran, which is like chill Catholicism, or a little less intense Catholicism. But, like, I mean, I was drinking underage communion at church.
Communion wine, you know? Sure.
That was, like, a thing, you know? I went through confirmation just so I could drink wine underage.
The Lutherans and the Catholics, they're like excited to go to church every week.
Yeah, like, we get to drink wine before noon.
Get a little nip.
Scott shows a great video in the class to get folks talking about what is sort of natural, and he shows a video about Welch's. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Because
we know that in some communion, folks drink grape juice instead of wine, and then there's sort of this argument that no, Jesus would have been drinking grape juice, not wine.
There's a wonderful, horrible advertisement with Alton Brown, you know, kind of pseudoscientific, and he's going on about how Welch's is natural, but you know, pasteurization that made for stable fruit juice to exist, you know, didn't exist until the 1800s. I like to say the steam engine is older than grape juice. Because the natural state of any type of fruit juice prior to that time would have been eventual fermentation and mm-hmm. preservation and enjoyment in the form of alcohol.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the other thing about alcohol. Like I threw out there that maybe if we'd only discovered it today, it would probably be illegal. But that's the thing. It's not. It is a discovery. We didn't have to go make it. It makes itself.
That's the thing. That's why we started... point out, you know, first of all, we all know that anything we drink is an agricultural product. We sometimes forget it. You know, if you're drinking Fireball, you might forget it's an agricultural product, but like anything you drink is, you know, it's fruits, it's grains, it's...
Drinking a Fireball, you're going to forget a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah. True. But, you know, alcohol is the natural state of fruit. I mean, eventually it's going to ferment into alcohol, and that's sort of more natural than just grape juice.
And the more stable form of grain in the long term, too, you know, if you're going to make, you know, eventually beer and then whiskey of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, all alcohol is, it's kind of like the same thought process as, like, cheese and charcuterie. It's like it's preserving the grain.
Yeah, yeah.
Turning it into something that's stable.
A commodity that you can swap and carry and, yeah.
Or just, you know, have throughout the long winters as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those winter nips.
Speaking of long winters,
yeah,
you have a bottle of whiskey here that was hanging around for about 15.
Speaking of long winters on the hottest day of the summer in New York City.
It's oppressive out there.
Oh. I like it. I love it, actually.
I've seen this whiskey before, and I think I've had it before, but this is a pretty cool one. You want to explain what we're...
Yeah.
Are we trying this? Or
yeah, please cool. Crack it open. This is a whiskey that was distilled. It's very cloudy. Who knows why? You know,
this looks like an Amaro right now.
Yeah, it looks like milky.
This is essentially the equivalent of, you know, if you were to buy Robitussin today and hold on to it for, you know, 80 years, This was never meant for long-term, you know, holding and enjoyment.
So vintage roboing, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so this was a bourbon that was distilled prior to Prohibition, and then Prohibition happened, so they couldn't sell it, and they held on to it, and then it was bottled after Prohibition. So it was probably aged too long to begin with. You don't see a lot of 17-year-old bourbons, and you certainly didn't see them this caliber of quality being probably not all that fancy at the time. Damon, you've got the bottle. Can you just read who produces this? It's the, I think, American Medical...
American Medicinal Spirits Company, Incorporated. So it says, Special Old Reserve. Fine old bourbon whiskey made in Kentucky before Prohibition, stored in the finest oak barrels for over 15 years, and bottled in bond under government supervision, especially for the stockholders of the National Distillers Products Corporation. It says...
Well, in the back it also says about it's for medicinal use only. This is pre-pro juice.
Made fall of 1917 and bottled in fall of 1932.
So right. This is something that you would actually, you know, a few distilleries were given special governmental dispensation to still produce or store or sometimes sell. But basically, this is something your doctor would give you a prescription for. You could get, you know, a quart or a pint of whiskey, but only with, you know, a pharmacist script.
It smells insane.
Yeah, it smells like...
It smells very medicinal. It's like, wow.
It passed the first test. I didn't go blind. It is palateless and...
I'm just going to... You know, they say it. This is disgusting.
Yeah, no, pencil. People sometimes ask me why I have the bottle left over, why I didn't consume all of it, and it's because, it's going to take a while. A few more radio shows, and we'll get through the final 3 ounces. Oh,
it's a dusty bottle, and it tastes
like
dusty.
Dust.
It tastes
like...
That's a little painful.
It tastes,
musty. Let's taste something else.
It tastes musty and dusty and old, and it's really cloudy.
Well, we'll taste something new. How about
people view the pass through kind of rose colored lenses, and this is a perfect example when you hit up against that reality that not everything that was old or produced from another era was more natural or better or more wonderful tasting.
So I brought in something from Asbury Park, New Jersey, where I live, and there's a distillery in town.
Proud New Jersey resident.
Woo! And Jersey Shore.
Wow.
And there's a great distillery in town, makes gin and vodka, and then also a double-barreled bourbon. And one of their distinctive products is a barrel-finish gin, which they put into... They aged their gin, made with New Jersey grains, into an unused barrel, age it for a bit, I don't know how long. And then then they age their bourbon in the barrels in which the gin was. And so the bourbon comes out with like all these wacky interesting botanical flavors.
Backwards.
Yes,
backwards.
I know. I don't think anybody's sort of doing that.
Can they label it bourbon?
Yeah, because they started it, it's double barreled. So they've started it off in a regular charred, unused barrel. And then they finish it off in a gin barrel. So we'll try this. We'll try this out. I don't know where to get rid of this whiskey I was drinking.
Let's see. Down your mouth isn't the good answer. We don't have a bottle of water.
I have some.
Dave, you're lucky you didn't get to try the whiskey. That's all I'm saying. Dave in the booth.
We saved some for you.
Yeah, you want it pass around. And it makes a really good old-fashioned, a little gin old-fashioned.
I love a Hollands or gin old fashioned.
I read about that in your book too.
Oh man, you're like studied up. But here's the weird thing. It's my first book, of course. I'm Just Here for the Drinks, available now on Amazon.com or at fine booksellers everywhere. I finished the book back in like April, and now suddenly people are asking me, telling me things about the book, and I'm kind of like, yeah, I forgot that.
Yeah.
Like I got it done.
Wait,
and
really?
I
said that?
I got it done, and I sort of put it out of my mind. Like, okay, done. Moving on.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is cool.
Outrageously delicious. Asbury Park Distilling Company. Never heard of these guys. Are they here in New York?
I haven't seen it.
No, I don't think they're distributed in New York yet. Yeah. Jersey distributed. Proud.
Yeah, I've had a lot of experience with barrel-aged gins. I like them a lot. And I like that you said that it makes a great old-fashioned, because I do like a gin old-fashioned.
I do, too. Like, I like a gin old fashioned. I like a gin old fashioned.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, Southern, you'd be intrigued about their distillery because, you know, where you at Amaro Margo have a very sort of limited, you're limited with what you can do, meaning that you have no citrus or anything, but mm-hmm. that forces you to be creative. The bar at Asbury Park Distilling can only use booze that they've made.
Yep.
And so they do have a restricted palette, so to speak, of paint colors, metaphorical paint colors, and they just come up with great, great drinks there.
Yeah, you know, boundaries impose creativity, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's it's one of the licenses that they have that says that they can be a distillery mm-hmm. and have a bar, but they can only have stuff on their bar that they make.
Right. And again, we probably have to go back to the 21st Amendment for all that wacky stuff.
Thank you, 21st Amendment.
Yeah, thank you, 21st Amendment. Sponsored by?
Just for letting every single state and even county have their own rules. That's just one of the dumbest things ever.
Like, I always remember that Nicole Austin would say when she was at Kings County Distillery that we don't live the legacy of Prohibition, we live the legacy of the end of Prohibition. That's really sort of when...
Right. Wow, what a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. That's when
we're still carrying the burden of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, besides firearms and the Second Amendment, alcohol is the only commercial good that you can buy or sell that's mentioned in the Constitution, which makes for pretty strange complications.
Wow, that's interesting.
I never really thought of that.
Man, it's great hanging out with nerds.
The feeling is mutual?
Yeah, we're nerds. But like, you're like super nerds. You're like academic nerds. You're like real deep.
You're professional nerds.
We're aspiring.
But we're all professional drinkers, though.
Well, that's true. We have our degree, but you have your PhD.
Hmm. This is great.
Wow.
Cool. We need to do a Jersey Shore show.
It's very...
right? Let's go to Jersey Shore and do it. An episode.
Well, before the summer runs out, mm-hmm. let's get down to the beach.
Dude, got to.
I haven't been to the beach one time this year. I've been kind of busy.
We all looks like we could use some vitamin D.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Well, we sit in the studio.
We live the life of vampires. We're
in a bar at night or
I see
studio.
The most daylight I see at any given time, actually, is the 45 minutes to an hour that we're in here because of this window.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm in a dark bar or I'm asleep. I don't have a clue what that was. Is there a snake in here? What was that?
I don't know.
Dave has no microphone, so he can't talk back today.
Thank God.
So he can't explain himself. Talk briefly a little more about this gin. It tastes very fruity to me.
Mm-hmm.
What's the base of this gin?
I think it's just grains. I think it's in New Jersey grains. I don't know what it is. I'll have to get back to you on that, Sutter.
Is it algae from the
We can look it up. It's
Shore.
Not algae, and it's not ridiculously old medicinal whiskey. Maybe that's why it tastes so fruity. After that whiskey, everything would.
Our palate's just wrecked now.
I know, what was so weird about that whiskey. It was so, many things were wrong. It was so single-dimensional, you know, so when you have this, it's like the Wizard of Oz going from black and white to Technicolor. It's like...
Yeah, absolutely. Like a real palate changer. Mm-hmm. So how many... I'm curious to know this. How many people from the food studies course are signing up for your class? Is it booked out?
It's a seminar, so it's small. It's designed to be a conversational class. So
sure.
It's, you know, 20, it's like 15 to 20, 15 to 25 folks usually.
Yeah.
And graduate students primarily.
And so you think it's going to be booked out? You don't know.
We don't know yet.
We've got a few more weeks.
Yeah.
If you're an NYU student that wants to sign up, now's the time.
Do we get to come sit in on
Can we audit a class or two?
Yeah, I sent Souther the syllabus, so you can pick whatever one appeals to you.
Nice.
So, we should, you know, the syllabus is designed thematically, sort of historically and thematically. So we start at the beginning with alcohol and religion and the first evidence of humans intentionally making alcohol. And then Then we move through to rebellion and alcohol.
Rebellion. We're going to do a walking tour of Lower Manhattan and look at the Customs House and visit Alexander Hamilton and Albert Gallatin's graves and talk about the Whiskey Rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And a lot of Prohibition.
Yeah.
This is the second time we're teaching this class, second semester, and we got feedback that people love Prohibition and wanted more. So there's three sessions, basically.
No. Nobody loves Prohibition.
No, they like more.
Loves learning.
Yeah.
About how difficult and hard
life
was.
And it's not just a U.S.-based class. It definitely has a European, North American focus, the course. But as we mentioned, we look at revolution and prohibition in Russia.
Rum and slavery is a topic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Huge, the rum triangle.
And then what else? We do coffee and tea and look at colonialism as well and how that sort of changed the face of things as well.
And lastly, one of my favorite topics is the 19th century.
You mean with Fireball?
we cover the 19th century, so the 1800s, technology and drinking. So, you know, we look at what a cocktail is, you know, which to my mind is, if we go to the original definition, right, sugar, water, bitters, alcohol, all of those things kind of existed in some form prior to, you know, the golden, you know, age in the 1850s, 1870s, 1890s. So why did it take thousands of years for people to invent cocktails? You know, it's this question. And it's because it's not until the technology develops that allows these things to become accessible. Ice in the 1820s via the ice trade. Column distillation in the 1820s and 1830s allows for the production of London dry gin, of grain whiskey, of vodka. The commercialization of trade routes and steamships allow for fruit to, you know, travel to places where you wouldn't normally have it. So, you know, as you can see, I get excited about
it. And then, I mean, the flip side of that is actually industrialization leads to prohibition, too, because as we mentioned, alcohol served as a source of hydration. And you can't prohibit alcohol unless you have a potable water supply. And so it took, you know, until the 1850s and onward for there to be a reliably clean water supply. Then you can restrict alcohol consumption at that point.
Crazy.
Makes a lot of sense.
Like,
yeah.
It's like a continuous cycle of chicken and egg, chicken and egg, chicken and egg. Which came first? Which came first? Which came first?
I'd like to talk about this real quick. Uh-oh. I mean, we're getting...
Chickens and eggs?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, basically... Like, the origin of alcohol, like, fermented alcohol, you know, like, I've heard the story about, like, someone noticed some birds who were eating some grapes that were infiltrated with yeast, and so the grapes had converted some of the juice in the actual grapes to alcohol, and the birds looked like they were having a really good time flapping around, doing their thing, and then the humans were like, I gotta get me some of them grapes. You know,
but actually, they would. I mean, humans or our ancestors have been able to process alcohol for 10 million years. So, right? And
about basically since humans became humans, Homo sapiens, about 200,000 years ago, we've had the necessary enzymes to break down alcohol. To some extent, they existed, but they didn't become prominent until the rise of agriculture, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. It isn't until we're steadily growing grain, have access to fruit and sweet things that we can ferment. But, you know, really important, and you see this in the mythology and religions and legends of all cultures. You know, you look at who was the first vintner according to Christianity? It was Noah. What you really need is civilization to some extent. You need pottery. You need containers. We often forget that you need containers.
But that's also why we say there's been 9,000 years of intentional alcohol consumption. It probably was earlier, but we have no physical evidence of it because pottery wasn't really invented till then. So any ways that humans were making alcohol before then, say in leather or baskets or something, they would have all disintegrated. So there's no record of it anymore. But I would say that the first beverage, the fermented beverage that humans probably had was mead, because that can sort of almost happen by itself, that you get a certain percentage of water and honey together in some sort of closed space, say like a hollow of a tree, and then there you've got mead. So that's probably the first, and then probably wine,
Every few years, there's a new academic study or archaeology dig that discovers some new vessel, and it's kind of a race between beer, wine, and mead for which came first by, you know, a few hundred or thousand years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the earliest evidence is China. It was a Hawthorn wine. Right now, is that still holding steady?
I believe so. Yeah. We'll wait another month or two until it doesn't.
Wow,
very cool.
History does change.
It do.
Well, guys, it's been great having you on. And
we got one more bottle to try, right?
I didn't see that. What do we got over there?
Makes learning easier.
Man,
so this is.
Let me finish this gin. Mm.
What is that, spritz? Bottled spritz?
This is it's called spritz because that's what it says on the European label, but this is just an aperitivo. So this would be used in a spritz. So this is a lighter style.
Walcher aperitivo. Hey, I wonder if Michael Walcher knows about this.
This is from Alto Adige, a distillery that dates back to the 60s, made with organic ingredients. Elderberry extract is what colors it, so naturally colored. And yeah, something been around in Europe for a while, but the company I work with and my day job just started importing this in May.
Cool.
Wait, what's your day job?
Importer and distributor. I'm like an anti-brand ambassador. I hide behind a desk and find things to import and come up with pricing and play in Excel.
But your grandma thinks you're an alcoholic.
True.
By trade.
That is true.
By trade. An alcoholic by trade. This is delightful. Got a little lightly peppery nose. A little red bitter action going on. Gentian, floral. Nasturtium? Is that weird? That's where that peppery thing is coming from.
Ooh. That's what you're saying.
Nasturtium flower.
Yeah.
And to balance out the sweetness, they actually use a little bit of organic lemon juice, interestingly.
Mm. Neat.
Mmm. That's quaffable.
Yeah.
Delicious. Yeah. I love how Damon wouldn't let us go until we finished the... We got it to
the
fourth bottle.
He's a member of the Clean Plate Club.
Yeah.
Always has been. Look at him. Wow, that's
15% alcohol.
15%, 30 proof. We could drink that one all day long. That's some session drinking.
I brought a beer koozie. I could just put it over the bottle and just.
Well, if it didn't have that governor on there. you know, the governor on the is a common thing on mostly bottles from Italy. And it took me a long time to understand why that was, but I did some work with Amaro Montenegro to finally get theirs removed in every country except Italy. Because in Italy, the governor, the thing that makes your bottle pour slowly, the governor in Italy is considered to be a mark of excellence. People regard because it's obviously not been tampered with. It's obvious that the it's obvious that the maker cares about their product. It's
and you can't chug it.
There's all these like pieces to the puzzle that make it an esteemable thing in Italy, which is so backwards thinking to me. Like I want to be able to get the stuff out of the bottle as fast as I can, exactly. And into my hand or into the hands of other people. Guys, really fascinating stuff. We'll have to have you back on and talk more about this maybe as the show, as your class goes on. I think it would be really fun, actually, Damon, if you and I could maybe go audit one of the sessions and bring a Zoom recorder and record some of it, some of you, and maybe interview even some of your students to see what they're thinking about the whole process.
Without giving away
we don't give away the show.
Obviously.
So thanks, Diana and Scott, for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for bringing this disgusting whiskey.
Anytime.
His pleasure.
Really
none
old,
of ours.
Rotten whiskey.
When was the last time you had a really disgusting thing on the show?
Yeah, that's true. It's been it's a
rarity.
You're
welcome.
Well, I thought that like someone brought us some Malort.
I love Malort, though. It's not disgusting.
But you know, the thing is, it was actually delicious. It was a fresh bottle.
Yeah.
A lot of people... Malort has a shelf life.
I agree.
So, like, when you get it fresh, it's like
it's like
floral and beautiful,
grapefruity and zesty.
Yeah, but if you let it sit around, which most people do,
yep,
then it becomes kind of a rancid product. But I'm still drinking it anyway.
All right, I'm gonna go over some show upcoming stuff. Check it out, man. Next week is our 300th episode.
Scott, we missed it by one.
More specifically, next week is your 300th episode.
Amazing.
That's incredible. It's incredible, Damon.
It's your 100th episode.
Something like that, yeah. We can we'll figure out the
when
math.
We did 200, that's when I announced you as my co-host.
Yeah, so that's right. You're right.
My 300th.
So officially,
you're
100. My
100th. Hey.
I got more in the bag, but yeah, that's amazing. So 300th episode next week is going to be Kara Newman. She's been on the show a few times before. She's got a brand new book coming out called Nightcap. It's all about drinks you drink right before you go to bed. And I'm pretty sure, Damon, that you're featured in that book.
I think I am.
No, you are. I know you are.
Yours is the only book that I'm not featured in.
I've actually seen it.
Yeah. We all love Kara Newman.
She's
why
the best.
Don't you look like nepotism or favoritism? We upcoming in no particular order, Chris Hanna and Nick Dietrich are coming up from New Orleans. They're going to actually do a pop-up at My Bar Blue Quarter next Wednesday. We're going to get them on the show as well to talk about their new bar, Jewel, which they're opening up down
maybe
in...
Maybe that's where we do our 300th episode party.
Man, oh man. Damon
coming
the,
together.
Damon with the quick thinking. Then we've got Jeremy Allen from Mini Bar out in L.A. going to be coming up following that. So we've got Kara Newman next week, and then in a couple weeks we've got Laura Newman, who used to live here in New York City. Now she lives down in Birmingham, Alabama. She's opening a brand new bar called Queens Park. Really booming and burgeoning scene down there. And then I don't know, other junk is coming up as well.
Got a lot of stuff coming up. We'll have that that interview with Bruce Russell and Benny Hurwitz and Joanne Street. They'll have that going. We've got a lot of travel going on right now,
and we've got some interesting things that are posted not under the show page on Heritage Radio Network. We've got a couple of things that are posted under I think what's called the blog page. I'll post some more information about this on Speakeasy Podcast Instagram and Speakeasy Radio Twitter. But we did remember when we went to Cleveland, we recorded so very many interviews while we were there. And it's about a 2-hour long episode that's posted on as a blog post. Plus, I recorded Let's Get Lit, a literary session out in LA where authors, including me now, read from upcoming works. So I read an excerpt from my book. Lots of great people were on that panel. Reading from works they hadn't published yet. So it's just a cool thing to listen to. So we got lots of extra cool content in addition to just the regular show. Because, you know, we're 300 episodes in, man. We got a lot to share.
We're big bosses.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Rolling deep.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the
show
today.
Thank you for having us.
Can't wait to have you on again. Can't wait to go and check out your class. Sounds amazing.
And yeah, we're pretty happy about it.
I hope that we didn't give too much away. No. For your students, you know?
No, they see the syllabus, they know.
Okay, cool. Yeah, definitely want to come check it out, right, Souther?
Yeah, absolutely. Seriously, let's do it.
Cool. All right. Well, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Check out heritageradionetwork.org for many more programs like this one, and click on the beating heart if you feel so kind to donate to the station so we can continue bringing you all this great information and these great guests. Until next week, cheers, y'all.
Cheers, guys. Ciao.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.